ever wonder what therapists talk about over coffee? Well, we're three clinical psychologists, Dr. Diana Hill, Dr. Ray Littlewood, and Dr. Debbie Sorensen, and we'd like to welcome you to Psychologists Off the Clock. In this podcast, you'll get a glimpse into the books we read, the research we think is interesting, and the ideas from psychology that we use to thrive in our own lives. Our webpage is www.offtheclockpsych.com, and there you can find resources we mention in this episode, as well as other podcasts we've posted. You can also find us on iTunes, Facebook, and Twitter. Thanks for listening.
Hi, Debbie. Happy New Year.
Hi, Diana. Happy New Year to you, too.
I'm excited about our topic for today because it feels really relevant for launching into 2017 and talking about some practices that may help us flourish more in our lives.
Well, I can't wait to hear what you have to say. I always look forward to the new year as a time to kind of take a step back and think about where I want to head. So I can't wait to hear what you have to say.
Yeah. Well, a lot of times people are generating intentions for the new year or resolutions for the new year. And what I was thinking about is taking a little bit of a different angle and generating more of practices for the new year. And this comes a lot from Kelly Wilson, who's the ACT co-founder, his approach to daily practices or practices that we add to in our lives on a daily basis to move in the direction of where we want our lives to be. But it's not necessarily that you're resolving to do anything or end anything, but just to practice at something. And the more we practice, it seems that the more that things change in the direction that we want them to be changing. So some practices that I want to talk about tonight are practices for flourishing. And recently, the field of psychology has been really shifting away from disorders and medical models of pathology towards models of well-being. In particular, this idea of flourishing was defined by Barbara Fredrickson, who's a psychologist, and she's a positive psychologist. So she talks about flourishing as living within an optimal range of human functioning, one that connotes goodness, growth, and resilience. There's also a psychologist and sociologist, Corey Keyes, who's at Emory University, who's studied quite a bit about flourishing. And he talks about flourishing as having high levels of emotional well-being when we're satisfied, when we see our lives have a sense of purpose, when we feel a degree of mastery and accept all parts of ourselves, and when we have a sense of personal growth, knowing that we're always evolving and changing. And he's studied flourishing in comparison to the sort of antithesis of flourishing, which is languishing, and has found that only about 18% of Americans are actually flourishing in their lives. So I was hoping in our new year, in 2017, we could talk about seven specific practices that we could be engaging in on a regular basis that would support us in flourishing.
Well, that sounds great. I even like that word flourishing. It just sounds so, I don't know, like you're blossoming into this wonderful well-being mode of living. So
yes,
we actually considered it. So anything that can help more than more people head that direction is great.
And we were considering flourishing for the name of our podcast when we were initially getting it going. So yeah, it's a nice one. So the seven practices, I think we're going to probably break this up into two podcasts. And the seven practices that contribute to a sense of flourishing in your life that you could be doing are: one, living by your values; two, holding your thoughts lightly; three, eating and moving nutritiously; four, cultivating sleep; five, generating self-compassion; six, practicing social connection over social comparison; and seven, resting in the present moment. So we're going to talk first, probably about with the first three tonight, of living by your values, holding your thoughts lightly, and eating and moving nutritiously. And some of these practices are drawn directly from acceptance commitment therapy, and others are drawn from more of a health psychology focus. But where I actually want to start comes from Katie Bowman, who's a biomechanist, and she actually studies movement patterns in our bodies and talks about a concept called diseases of captivity. So she argues that a lot of the problems that we have in our bodies, like our back pain and other health problems, are related to a mismatch between our genes and our environment in which we live. And she uses animal models as an example of this. So she talks about the orca whale, which, you know, those beautiful orca whales that are in SeaWorld?
Mm-hmm.
And they all have this characteristic, or a lot of them have a characteristic, when they're held in captivity, of a floppy fin. So their fin kind of flops over. It doesn't have any cartilage to hold it up straight. Or it has cartilage, but the cartilage isn't held up straight. And part of the reason why orcas have this floppy fin is because they need to take really deep dives into the ocean, and they need to swim in big waters in order for the water pressure to hold up their fins. So Katie Bowman argues, like, what, you know, that there's something going on here that may actually map on to humans. There's ways in which our human bodies aren't, you know, matching our environment. We probably shouldn't be sitting all day. We probably should be waking with the sun and going to bed with the sun. And Kelly Wilson has argued that maybe some of our psychological problems are also diseases of captivity. So if we think about depression and anxiety and this mismatch between our environment and our genes, so thinking about ways in which maybe we have gotten disconnected from what matters to us in our lives, or how we may be getting entangled in our fear thoughts and our sort of negative thinking patterns, maybe how we're sleep deprived or sleeping less, we've become more self-critical or comparing ourselves to others through social media, or maybe we've also become more inactive in our lives and not moving our bodies out in nature, and maybe eating foods that our bodies aren't really designed to eat. So these could all be examples of sort of our own human floppy fin. And you could do things like put a cast on the fin, or, you know, give the orca whale some medication to help its fin stand up straight, or you could just also release it out into open waters. So these practices that we're talking about tonight, I really think, are the practices of how to release ourselves out into the open waters so that we can flourish in our lives and be really more in a match for what we're meant to be doing.
Can I give a little example of something similar?
Yeah.
So my kids, a couple weeks ago, we just had one of those periods where they were a little bit cooped up for a few days.
Mm-hmm.
One was sick, and we just had some stuff going on where they didn't get out much. And all of a sudden we let them outside, and they were literally like just running nonstop, pretty much just in circles around me for about half an hour.
Yeah.
And I was just so struck by how they had all that energy just waiting to go. And the minute they had the chance to get, you know, freedom, to be released, they just ran and ran and ran.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what children are designed to do.
Their little bodies wanted to move.
Exactly. And, you know, I think as adults, our bodies want to move too, but we've just gotten pretty disconnected from that desire to move. And we've put it in a have to kind of context, or in certain environments that are actually not super enjoyable to be moving in, you know, standing on a Stairmaster for 30 minutes, not necessarily always the most enjoyable, versus going outside and running around and running on the beach and hanging from trees and, you know, doing things that are more natural to our body. So we'll talk about that in the movement patterns component. Let's start, though, with values, because I think that that's often a place that I start in my therapy practice with people as an ACT therapist, and is really the foundation of the why. Why are we going to do sort of the hard work that we're going to do in therapy, or why even do some of this hard work of the practices to support ourselves in flourishing? And values, you know, they're a sense of meaning, and meaning in life is an important factor in terms of our well-being. And you probably wouldn't be surprised that research has shown that people who have a sense of meaning and purpose in their lives are happier than those without a sense of meaning. There's also a concept within ACT called psychological flexibility, which is this idea that you have the ability to move in the direction of what's important and meaningful to you, even when you're faced with difficult sensations or memories or emotions that may arrive. So being flexible in our lives is being able to continue to move in the direction of where we want to be going in our life, in our relationships, in our work, even when it is difficult underneath our skin to do so. So it's a direction. And what's an analogy that I often use with values is one of like a compass, where you can be pointing your compass in the direction of north any point in time. So they're very much in the here and now. We can be pointing that direction and making a step towards our value direction. And we don't actually ever really get to our value. It's not something you get to. It's something that you're acting in the here and now, which is different than a goal. So a lot of times around the New Year's, people may be setting goals for themselves around, you know, changing some of their drinking patterns or wanting to work less or, you know, specific goals. But with values, we're looking at what is the why underneath that goal that you could be acting in your life right now. So say you want to be decreasing your drinking. Maybe there's a value there around, I want to be more present with my partner at night. Or maybe there's a value around, I want to take care of my body. And it's helpful to clarify what the value is underneath the goal when you are setting goals for yourself, because it helps as a motivator to continue in that direction. Mm-hmm. Is there anything you want to add to or say about values in the new year, or how you use that in your practice?
Well, I also focus quite a lot on values in my work. I usually go back to it again and again with clients I work with for a while. And it's something that in my own life, I feel like I'm always just trying to reflect on my values and check in. Mm-hmm. So I think the new year is a good time to reflect back on how things have been going and what areas of your life that you value, you know, have you been maybe not paying enough attention to, and to think about, you know, maybe changes you want to make in terms of how you're living your values, and use that start of a new year as a chance to reflect. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be the start of a new year. You can do it any time, really, but mm-hmm. I don't know, periodically when things sort of transition in my life, I like to just use that as a chance to stop and reflect on that.
Mm-hmm. And there's some kind of fun, concrete ways which we can practice developing our values and understanding what our values are. And one of the ways that I really like to do in therapy is I have people identify their values within certain domains. So we have the domain of the environment, or the domain of career, or the domain of friendship or family or partnership. And within that domain, I ask some questions, which are things like, how well do you feel like you're aligned with who you want to be in this area? And if you were more aligned with who you want to be, what would you be doing that would be different? How would you be spending your time? What kinds of specific things, if I were to kind of follow you around throughout your day, and I could say, oh, this person, it's so clear that the environment is important to them. What would I be seeing in your daily actions? So we really want to get some concrete behaviors that demonstrate your values within certain domains. And sometimes I'll also have people rate how important a domain is to them, and then how well they feel that they're aligned with that domain. And when you have a domain that's very important to you, but you're not feeling aligned with it, and there's a big discrepancy there, oftentimes that causes a lot of distress. And so that can be sometimes what people are coming into therapy is because of that exact reason. So looking at in particular areas where you feel there's a lot of discrepancy for yourself, and that would be maybe a place to start doing some small practices that would be more in line with your values. Another practice that I do with clients is, have you heard about the choice point from Joseph Sirochi?
Yeah, I've actually used that with some of my clients.
Do you like
it? I really like it.
Yeah, I like it too. He's an Australian professor, and he has come up with a very simple model, which is basically that multiple times throughout our daily experiences, we come across situations where we have a choice, and the choice is either to be moving in the direction of our values or moving away from our values. And there is actually a worksheet that you can do where you write down the situation and the choice point, and then you write down what would be moves that would be towards your values and what would be moves that would be away from your values. So do you have an example of a time that you've used that with a client or?
I think most of the time that I've used it is with people who are consistently stuck in a area of their life. So it might be health, or it might be like video game addiction or something. Mm-hmm. I don't know, something like that, where they can kind of pause in that moment and make a choice about their behavior. Mm-hmm. And I like the visual, on the worksheet, it looks like a Y. Mm-hmm. So you're kind of walking along and then you stop at that moment and you can go one way or the other. Mm-hmm. And I use it as a tool to try to get people to stop in that moment and use a little bit more, I guess, conscious choice.
Mm-hmm. So I'd like
well,
to
and I think, mm-hmm. I think within the context of relationships, this can be really important as well. So if you're doing something problematic in a relationship, like, you know, with withdrawing or yelling or something like that. Mm-hmm. And repeatedly throughout the day, the week, the month, you have opportunities to make a decision about how you're going to react to whatever's going on in the context of the relationship. And it's that same idea that, oh, maybe last time I, you know, withdrew and used the silent treatment or something like that. But, you know, at this time, I'm going to do something that's more in line with my value. I'm going to act in a more, you know, compassionate, loving kind of way.
Yeah. And when you get clear on what that is, it's helpful. It's like your roadmap of, okay, that's the direction that my intention that I'm going to be moving in. And I may not be perfect in it, but I can get to that choice point and choose again. Yep. And the other idea that I like around it is that we're going to be coming across choice points multiple times. So even if you come up to a choice point and you move away from your values, there's going to be another opportunity probably within an hour or two to have another opportunity to choose your value direction. And it's different than, you know, you've either broken a rule or you've kept to the rule, but it's much more flexible in that we have an opportunity again, over and over again, we have an opportunity to return to our valued action.
Exactly.
And it's that return. It's sort of like the same thing of when we're meditating and we notice that we're not paying attention to our breath. It's actually the return to your breath that strengthens that action. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing as like a bicep curl. It's the actual lifting up the weight that strengthens the bicep. It's not the holding the weight up. And that's the return back to our values.
Yep.
So wonderful. So that's the first practice for flourishing, is living by your values. The second practice, which also comes from ACT, is holding your thoughts lightly. So sometimes I'll be working with a client and we'll get really clear on, okay, these are my values around my relationship or my values around my work. And I'm going to go out and, you know, live by my values. But what we find is there's something that shows up along the way, which is our minds. And our minds are constantly, chronically jabbering away at us and telling us all sorts of things, some of which are helpful and a lot of which may not be helpful. Some research suggests that we have between 50 and 70,000 thoughts a day. And a lot of those thoughts are not spoken thoughts. They're ones that are just the commentary that's going on in our mind, continuously producing thought. And more often than not, these thoughts can tend towards being a little bit more negative. And that just has to do, again, with sort of our evolutionary biology, that we are the ancestors of people that we're a little bit fearful. Because if you were a little bit fearful and you ran back into the cave when you thought that a bush was rustling, then probably you were the person that survived. So being a little bit negative, have a little bit of a negativity bias, can be beneficial for you evolutionarily wise. But in the present world, it's not always so beneficial. So if you're going to a work meeting and you have thoughts that are negative about you and you run back home and you don't go to the meeting, that may impair your ability to be, you know, effective at your job. Rick Hansen, who's a neuropsychologist, says that our brains are Velcro for the negative and Teflon for the positive. and that negative stimuli are perceived more quickly and easily by our brains, and that it takes, you know, pretty rapidly when we have a negative experience, it gets stored into our memory, but it takes about 12 seconds of lingering on a positive experience for it to get stored in our memory. So really those negative experiences are what stick and what we hold on to, and then also what we project into the future. So here come along our thoughts, and they get in the way with oftentimes acting on our values. So some of the thoughts that may get in the way would be things that we've talked about, like excuse making, or we get hooked by fears or ideas and projections about what something may be like, and we often think it's going to be a lot worse than it is. Do you have any examples of that for you or your clients in terms of how thoughts can hook you?
Oh, I mean, all the time. I think that thing about assuming that it's going to be worse than it is,
yeah,
that comes up a lot for me, because a lot of times I spend all this time dreading something and stewing over it and repeatedly telling myself, okay, I need to do this thing. I need to do this thing. And I just, I don't feel like it. And it's not going to go well. And I just get myself so worked up. Mm-hmm. And then like 9 times out of 10, I go do it. And I'm like, oh, that actually wasn't that bad.
Right. But the suffering has already happened because you've already rehearsed all the horrible fears. And just getting through the holidays, I imagine there's probably things that retroactively we can look back on and say, oh, well, that it actually wasn't that bad. I was, you know, I was worried about traveling here. I was worried about, you know, having dinner with this person. And it actually turned out different. You know, there's two typical ways which we tend to respond to these unwanted thoughts. And one of them is just to believe them as the truth and get all entangled in them and just let them run the show. And that can, you know, that can often be the case, that we just listen to our negative thoughts or we listen to our fearful thoughts and follow wherever they tell us to go. And then another way that we often will respond is to try and suppress them or battle them. And that one, unfortunately, is also not as helpful, because there's something called the sort of rebound effect in thought suppression, which is the more that you actually try and suppress the thought, the more that you have an area of your brain that starts to monitor for that exact thing that you're trying to not think about and becomes like the hall monitor for the unwanted thought. And you're much more likely to end up having the thought that you're trying to suppress. So, so these two attempts to control, our attempt to control our thought or getting entangled in our thought, neither of which are very helpful. And what acceptance and commitment therapy offers is another alternative, which is the idea of holding your thoughts lightly, or what's also called cognitive diffusion, which is being able to step back a little bit and just notice your thoughts for what they are. They're sort of like, like bad news radio, you know, going on, and that you don't have to actually listen to them or get entangled with them or try and get rid of them. And that's the idea of cognitive diffusion. I really liked a quote by Susan David, who just wrote a new book called Emotional Agility. And she said, who do you want to be in control, your thoughts or your thinker? And I like that idea, because oftentimes we're letting our thoughts be in control and not our thinkers. But really what would be more helpful is to just notice our thoughts rather than getting caught up in them or buying into them. But asking ourselves, is this thought helpful? Is it aligned with the direction I want to be going in? Or if I listen to this thought, will it derail me from my valued action?
Mm-hmm. I've used an analogy with a lot of my clients. It's like when you see somebody who's being dragged down the street by their dog on the leash. Mm-hmm. And everyone always makes this joke, oh, who's walking who?
Oh, yeah.
Well, it's like that with your thoughts.
Totally.
Who's walking you? Are you walking your thoughts, or are your thoughts walking you? And sometimes when your thoughts really, you know, you get really kind of sucked into the thoughts, it feels like your thoughts are dragging you around.
Right. Right. And when you're fighting your thoughts, you're also getting caught in them, because you're not able to be present with, you know, if you're fighting your thoughts about your, you know, say you have OCD and you're fighting your thoughts about, you know, getting germs on you, then you're not able to be present with the person that you're sitting with at the, you know, at the movies because you're so worried about the germs and trying not to think about the germs on the movie seat. You know, that there's that the fight is also just as who's walking who as well. So what are some strategies that you use around cognitive fusion or holding thoughts lightly with your clients or with yourself? How do you practice that?
Well, I really believe that the first most important step is awareness. So thinking about my own thoughts and practicing diffusion myself, if I can get to the point where I start to be aware that about what's going on with my thoughts, at that point, it's like a cakewalk because it's the being aware part that to me is the hardest. So I think for my clients, I do a lot of work around that. You know, we'll like maybe write down their thoughts verbatim. We'll kind of play around with them. And really what I'm trying to get them to do is to get a different perspective on their thoughts and to start to just even be aware that that's what's happening.
Right.
How about you?
Yeah, I talk a lot about the mind. And I even, you know, even Debbie, as we're talking now, there's you talking, there's me talking. Then I have my own inner commentary in my mind while I'm talking. Right?
It never stops.
Yeah. And there's people that are listening that have their own inner commentary about whether it's about the podcast or maybe their mind has wandered off to something else. And that it's, it never stops. And that awareness of, okay, my mind is going to be constantly producing thoughts like a pasta machine. And I can be a little bit just aware of its constant commentary and getting them concretized in the way that you're talking about of writing them down or even just pointing out, oh, I'm noticing, you know, my mind is telling me this right now, gives a little bit of distance from our thoughts. And I actually think that meditation can be really helpful in this arena, or mindfulness, short mindfulness practices, because it strengthens that muscle of being able to notice, become more of the thinker and not infused with the thoughts.
It does. It's practice getting into that mode of awareness and perspective taking related to thinking.
So the approach of cognitive diffusion is actually a little bit different from or holding our thoughts lightly is a little bit different from cognitive behavioral approaches, which are actually trying to change our thinking patterns. And it's nice to just have that distinction of that we don't always have to change what we're thinking. We don't always have to get in there and decide whether it's a rational or irrational thought, that sometimes we can just allow it to be there. But then it's really more important what we do with our hands and our feet. And that goes back to the first practice of values. So the first practice is of values. The second practice is holding our thoughts a little bit more lightly. And then the third practice that I want to talk about today is eating and moving nutritiously. And so now we're in the realm of more of health psychology, which we're actually finding there's a whole lot less distinction between what, you know, sort of what's happening in our minds and what's happening with our bodies, that they interact with and interchange with each other. So we're built to eat real food and move in ways which are much different probably from the ways in which we're eating and moving in our current lives. And we know that good nutrition is associated with all sorts of things like better sleep, better learning, better mental health, and that really small things matter and that patterns matter in the way that we feed ourselves. I really like Michael Pollan and his, he wrote The Omnivore's Dilemma, but he also wrote this really sweet book called Food Rules. And some of the food rules that he talks about in it are I think are spot on. So he says things like, don't eat food that won't eventually rot. So if it's not going to rot, don't eat it. And then I love this one where he says, don't buy food where you buy gasoline.
Hard to find nutritious food in the gas station.
It really is. And that is definitely food that won't rot, right? And she could be there for 20 years. And
that hot dog that's been going around the rotisserie for 2 days.
Sweating on the rotisserie for 2 days. Right. So what we know is that, you know, it's in the realm of food, is that food scientists have designed our current food environment around this concept of a bliss point. So around the idea of creating the most heightened sensory experience that will make you want to go back to eating the food. So there's a Stephen Witherly, who wrote the book, Why Humans Like Junk Food, the inside story on why you like your favorite foods and the cuisine secrets. And what he talks about is there's specific ways in which our food has been really designed by scientists. So it has things like a dynamic contrast. So there's different sensations within the same food. So you can think about like a crispy exterior of an M&M and a soft interior, that having that contrast really hits our bliss point and makes us want to go back for more. Food has been designed to increase your salivary response so that your saliva is increased, which increases your sensation in your taste buds. And so we have things in foods like sauces and emulsifiers, which make food more desirable. Foods have like a vanishing caloric density. So think of foods that they melt in your mouth right away so that they tell your brain that you're not full, even though they have a lot of calories to them. So the Cheez-It is a perfect example of that, right? You wouldn't get full on a bag of Cheez-Its. But also the same thing is foods have this really heightened specific sensory response so that your brain, it overcomes your brain's sort of ability to habituate to a food because it has such a high taste experience. So it overstimulates your taste buds. So if you think about, you wouldn't necessarily eat 4 apples in a row, but calorically equivalent to that, you would eat that much of Doritos because it stimulates your brain in such a way. So our food is designed basically to trick us. And one of the things that we're finding is that our bodies actually respond to eating foods that are from nature, from its, as closer to the earth as possible. And that actually impacts our mental health. So it impacts our gut microbiome, which more and more research is showing that it's also related to our mental health, as well as a whole lot of other series of things. It impacts our inflammation, which also has been shown to be related to mental health. Things like depression they're looking at that and its relation to inflammation in the brain. And that we actually would really benefit, I think, from getting into a practice of just eating more what would be closer to the earth and nutritionally, not on the basis of like nutritionally, like eating a lot of things that just because they have vitamins in them, but eating them because that's what our bodies were more designed to eat. Mm-hmm. Sort of eating like how you would feed your toddler.
Mm-hmm. Well, and food that you actually cook yourself.
Yeah.
If you want to make a very small change in your diet, start cooking more frequently. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be anything complicated. It doesn't have to be gourmet, just something that you made yourself. That's almost always in the direction of being healthier, real food. Mm-hmm. Because you're not going to put a bunch of preservatives and a ton of sugar and salt in something if you're making it yourself.
There's also something to be said that when you are cooking food, you're doing some other things too. You're standing up, you're moving around your kitchen, you're, probably thinking about your family, you're engaging in the whole experience of preparing food, which is what we're also sort of designed to do. So if you send, mm-hmm. If you send kids out into just like a, backyard nature, you will find them collecting little berries, collecting little things, pretending mm-hmm. like they're making food, right? Because mm-hmm. We're sort of designed to do that. And if we have distilled our food, so we've gotten so far away from that practice, it's really important. I think mm-hmm. about in the morning. So this is something that I feel really passionate about in my life and in raising my children. And you will see it sort of in the way that we've set up our home. But in the mornings, my youngest wakes up really early. And so my favorite thing to do with him is we walk down to the chicken coop and we take our little compost bin and we give our scraps from the night's dinner to the chickens and we collect the eggs and then we walk back and we go through the garden and we collect some greens from the garden and then we go up to the house and we make our breakfast. And there's a whole series of things that are really beneficial in that practice. So one is our eyes are getting exposed to early morning light, which is important for setting our circadian rhythms and our sleep later in the day. We're moving to get our food. We're walking down there. We're walking back. It's not exercise, but we're moving. And that's mm-hmm. actually, I would say, is even more important than exercising, is just moving in our day. And then we're also kind of connected to this whole cycle of where our food comes from, a sense of gratitude, and we're with each other. And that to me is, I think, getting back to, not that everyone has to have chickens in a garden, because it's not possible for everyone.
I was going to say, that sounds delightful.
It sounds delightful. But yeah. We could do things like go to our farm, you know, local farmer's market, and get the food. And you're meeting the farmer, and you're walking around, and you're picking out and having just a different relationship with that piece of produce that you picked out from the pile of produce, you know, and that you know where it was grown, than just, you know, grabbing the, you know, the bag of whatever from the frozen section. It just has a different feel to it. And that there's ways that we can establish, you know, sort of our nutritious patterns. If you go back to the tiny habits and the behavior change episodes that we did, that you can create tiny habits with food behaviors, things around how to prepare your meal in a, you know, easier way. And, you know, sometimes I'll make a smoothie at night and put it in the refrigerator. So all I have to do is blend it in the morning, you know, things like that, that help you out, so that you can ride that motivation wave. Linking your eating to your values, I think, is also really important, of getting clear on what are your values around food, and that those are going to be different for, I think, for everybody, just like how people have different favorite colors, and your favorite color may be blue and mine may be green. Green is not better than blue. So some things around your relationship with food may be that you have values around, maybe say you want to make sure that you have the ethnic foods from your background and your heritage, and practicing some of those principles in sharing that with your family. And that would be something that would be a value that could guide some of your choices and how you eat and how you cook. And then the last one is, I think, also structuring your environment to support your eating practices and whatever you decide those to be based on your values. So I know that for our family, like if I make a big batch of kale chips and I put it on the center of our table, they will get eaten. Whatever is on the center of the table will get eaten. So if I put kale chips out there, if I put potato chips out there, that'll get eaten. And so that's a way of structuring and supporting. And we know that from, you know, some of the research on like convenience stores. If they put fruit by the front of the convenience store, people are more likely to purchase a piece of fruit when they go into the convenience store than if it were in the back of the store. So doing that for yourself, structuring your environment in a way that the foods that you want to be increasing in your life are available to you, as opposed to thinking about removing things or getting rid of things, thinking about what you want to bring in and what you want to enhance in your nourishment.
Yeah. Well, that sounds really good. I mean, I know in my household, we work a lot. It's really important to us to expose our kids to a whole bunch of different foods and that we have them involved in cooking. And this is just a really helpful reminder of that value that I have. You know, I don't always 100% follow that value. I have been known to eat Cheez-Its, but...
And it's not that there's good. It's not that there's good food or bad food. It's just knowing... It's like sort of knowing, like, okay, this is what's been done with this food.
When I do eat something like that, I don't feel, my body can tell, you know, it doesn't feel nourished, and, you know, it doesn't give you that sense of being really connected to your food. So, so it's just a really good thing to keep in mind. And I know a lot of people take a look at nutrition and eating and weight loss and that kind of thing around the new year. And I think this idea that, you know, it's not about going on some really restrictive diet or totally eliminating a particular food group. It's more just that practice piece, just day in, day out, just keeping this in mind and getting to that choice point where you maybe, instead of reaching for the Cheez-Its, you reach for the kale chips or a piece of fruit or something that's more of a whole food. And, you know, you go for the Cheez-Its, then you go back to the to the apple the next time.
Right.
So it's a great practice to keep in mind in the new year.
Yeah. So the sort of the other piece of that is the nutritious movement. And that's a term that actually Katie Bowman has coined, which is nutritious movement. And she talks about movement as not just being about that hour that you do or half hour or 20 minutes that you do when you go to a gym, that actually the movement patterns that happen in our lives throughout our day may matter even more than what's happening in our gym. So an analogy may be like, say you're going to fast food, but you get a side salad with your fast food. the side salad is going to the gym, right? Like you can add that in and it's helpful, but it's not addressing what sort of the bigger picture problem may be, which is that we've really gotten away from, and our environment is structured in a way that really decreases our movement. Everything from, you know, remote control to, you know, you don't even have to pick up the phone anymore. I mean, when I was a kid, the phone was stuck to a wall. So if it rang, you had to stand up and walk. Boy, we don't even have to do that anymore. You know, so everything in our environment has been structured in a way that we just don't have to move. And there's a whole lot of things that about movement that are really important for our mental health as well as our physical health. So we know that movement is like good medicine. It's as effective as antidepressants for depression. And with exercise, we see improved stress response, mood, energy, alertness, stamina, improved sleep. And we also know that movement's essential for a healthy immune system. So our lymphatic system is one that actually moves better when we have movement in our body. If you think about it, like stagnant waters breed disease. So the same kind of things for our bodies. And movement and exercise is sort of like miracle grow for our brain. So it increases what's called brain-derived neurotrophic factor, which is like a fertilizer for new neuron growth, in particular in the hippocampus, which is an area of the brain that's really important for memory and cognition and learning. They've done research at University of Utah School of Medicine, where they found that people who got up and moved around for at least 2 minutes every hour had a 33% lower risk of dying. So getting up from your desk, moving around, and moving in different ways can really be helpful just for your longevity as well. And ways in which, this is another way that we can kind of think about ways in which we structure our environment to support movement. So for example, when you enter into my home, we've taken away all the furniture in front of, so we do have a screen that's behind like a, you know, like a cabinet, and we've taken away all the furniture in front of that. So I have two boys and there are football games, Broncos, in our home. But when the football games are happening, there is an open floor in front of that screen. And so there is tackling, there is football being thrown, there is climbing all over dad, and there is movement while we're watching movement on TV. Same thing with the Olympics. Uh-huh. We were like trying out stuff while we were watching the Olympics. And that's just because we've structured an environment in a way that there is not a couch in front of the TV. Other ways in which we can structure our environment is, you know, things like standing desks or, you know, that I think that's become pretty popular. But even if you're at a standing desk moving around, you know, I've been doing a practice of trying to get moving between each client where I'm standing up and I'm squatting. And there's some, Katie Bowman talks about macronutrients of movement. So the macronutrients being things like squatting, walking, hanging from things. So if you watch kids, what they'll do, if there's any kind of low bar anywhere, a kid will just naturally want to hang from it. My oldest was 3 years old, we had to put a pull-up bar in his bathroom because he kept on hanging from the towel racks and pulling them off the wall.
Yeah, that's hard on towel racks.
It's hard on towel racks. And so what do you do? Put up a pull-up bar because obviously this kid needs to hang. Why do we need to hang? Because we all needed to hang to learn how to pull ourselves up into a tree to get away from things that were going to eat us on the ground, right? But somewhere along the way, we stop hanging. So it's a good idea to hang from things. It's like our bodies are designed to do that. And so thinking about how can we structure in, it's not just about going to a gym and that, for some people, I don't even know if going to the gym is all that great. You know, like if you could be outside in nature and moving, it probably would have a lot more benefit as well.
Yeah. You know, I noticed I used to use a Fitbit to keep track of steps. It broke and I haven't replaced it. But when I was doing that, I really noticed that on the days when I was just sort of immersed in just work around the house, you know, it could just be running around packing up a suitcase or folding some laundry or tidying up or something like that. Yeah. I could easily get my 10,000 steps, just going about my day.
Right.
But then on the days when I would be at work, you know, mostly sitting, even if I got up periodically, my steps were so much lower.
Right.
And I just think that in our society today, we tend to spend a lot of time at the computer, on the couch. And it just, it's so different how much we move in our day-to-day life in that artificial environment.
So there's ways, put your laptop on your coffee table, but then squat down next to it and type. It's a different experience, you know, and or put it on the kitchen counter and kind of pace back and forth. The 1 hour a day of going to the gym and then sitting in your office for 11 hours, the 1 hour is not outdoing the 11 hours of sitting. It probably would be, you know, if you could actually just not go to the gym and do 11 hours of moving about in an ambient way, like you said, you would be getting just as much, you know, movement, but it would be actually probably better for your system to be moving your body throughout the day. So that's a practice.
Yeah. And it really lends itself easily to one of the tiny habits that we talked about in another podcast, which is just getting up and moving for 2 minutes, you know, every hour.
Yeah.
If you're sitting at the computer all day. So minor and yet could make such a big difference in terms of how you feel.
So those are the three practices that we're going to be launching this week, and then next week we're going to talk about four more. So tonight it was about living by your values, holding your thoughts lightly, and then moving and eating nutritiously. And maybe folks can try that, try some of those things this week, or maybe even thinking about some practices in the new year that you want to take on. And then next time we talk, we'll talk about sleep, self-compassion, practicing social connection over social comparison, and then resting in the present moment. So those are the next four for the second part of the Flourish.
Sounds great. Such a great way to start the new year. Thank you so much, Diana.
Yeah, I'm super excited, and I look forward to seeing you next week.
Me too. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Psychologists Off the Clock. You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and iTunes. You can also find us at www.offtheclockpsych.com. That's Off the Clock, PSYCH.com. Music by John Gu and Susie Stevens.